Greetings, artists, creatives, and innovators. You are now tuned into the High Water Podcast, pop culture-driven advice for artists and creatives. I am your host, Chaka, and the last episode of this season is dedicated to one of my favorite cultural events. In early August, I literally took the show on the road and brought my recorder, my lav, and my prayers, since I had never recorded in the field before, to the 5th Annual Black Star Film Festival. The Black Star Film Festival is unlike any other festival in the country. It manages to mix a combination of great artistic innovation. I'm always looking at and looking to Black Star to figure out where the next wave is in terms of media that's geared towards the African American experience. And it's also a beautiful nod to the more family aspects of the kind of institutions that Black people create together. We have elders such as Haile Jerima and Julie Dash, who I met and barely kept my composure for, as well as a very well thought out and compelling youth program. And that's not even to say anything of the many, many works in the festival themselves. Black Star this year was a feast for both my Black eyes and ears, and I had the opportunity to talk to the latest and greatest in the world of cinema, of the diaspora. I had the great fortune to talk to Mr. Terrence Nance. Terrence is probably best known for his feature debut, An Oversimplification of Her Beauty. He is also a prolific experimental short director, producer, as well as the director of music videos, which is actually how he came about the concept for the short he submitted to Black Star this year. It's called Une Vie Très Longue, and we had a chance to talk about it here.
The film is called Une Vie Très Longue, mm-hmm. and it was a short film that the original prompt to make it was actually because it's a music video for the artist who produced it, Akua Naru. And, you know, she was like, I want to make a music video. And I told her, I don't make music videos. So then, you know, she was like, I still want to do whatever we can do. And so I said, you know, I have a feature that I kind of need to test out as a short film. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, we can maybe do that and use some music. And, you know, you're based in Europe, so I think it'd be a challenge and more fun and interesting to base it somewhere in Europe. And the original, the feature film that it was based on, I had a feature script. It was the first feature script I ever wrote. It was originally called Full Blown Aquarian. Now it's called Entangled, maybe. But, you know, I wrote it when I was really young, and it was based on a dream I had, or a recurring dream or daydream. I don't know if it was just a vision that I consistently had for a few years when I was younger. And it was me seeing on the subway this woman who was kind of tall, around my skin color, had like hair like mine, but was a little red, kind of like yours, color-wise. She didn't look exactly like me, but she looked maybe like a more feminized, quote-unquote, whatever I mean, version of me. And she would kind of just look at me like, you know, the come hither look, like. And it was just sort of like understood, like, this is my soulmate or whatever, you know, like. I was just, and it kind of like felt like a premonition, like, oh, this is gonna happen one day in New York, and whatever. But you know, I started to understand like this is never gonna happen, and then like, then also, she also had like a blue shirt on, jeans, like a blue t-shirt, like a really well-worn one, and so certain parts of the dream would continue to happen, like, you know, Chanel, my wife, so like when I met her. I met her before I started having that dream because I met her when I was 17. But she always wore this blue shirt that was like the same blue shirt. But she doesn't look like me. So it's like parts of it would have, you know, come true, quote unquote. But not in that way, in that simple way that I was having the dream. So I started to understand the dream more as like, this is my feminine side. This is just me. This is my femininity, like embodied. Well, maybe I'm not as in touch with as is actually natural or healthy. You know, so then that kind of developed into a story about like a kind of comedy about two people who fall in love, you know, but then one of them kind of develops this theory that he's a narcissist and that she is just a figment of his imagination because they're too similar, and that he's just falling in love with his feminine side. And she develops a theory that, no, she's the narcissist and he's just her masculine side. So the whole movie is them trying to prove to each other that I'm the real one and you're the one who's not real. And so that was the feature. And then, like, I just was like, okay, well, what would a short film? I didn't want to take a piece of it and make a short film of it. So I decided to just write something new that was the past life of those two characters. So that's how that came out. It's like, I just sort of thought about what their past life would be. In some way, it's about, I don't really know exactly, because I was making it like I make all the things from my subconscious. But when I watch it, I think maybe that the connection I make as a viewer, not as a creator of it, is that maybe there's like, when you're a man, when you're, that your body defines your experience of the world in a certain way, whether or not you actually identify with what your body happens to be. So like the guy character, you know, has a male body, and so he thinks he can physically protect her or charm her or whatever his body, he socialized for his body to sort of do in terms of behavior when you meet a woman. But there's a specific thing that having the body of a woman he doesn't have access to, which is like the threat of violence from men, you know, and that the death functions like maybe as like a male guilt for that, you know, that he, which I think is something that I've experienced, but in the movie kind of, at least for me, played like an escape from that male body, from the privilege of the male body, and like not even the privilege, but also like the inability, the fundamental inability to understand the femininity that is within you if you just happen to have a male body, because you're socialized. And not even because, but you just don't. You just will never have access to it unless you die. Especially black, you know, or men of the diaspora deal with is like pantomiming, feeding a hypermasculinity that we are taught is useful. You know, whether it's socially useful, economically useful, whatever, and that's a certain kind of masochism because it murders what is most natural to you. Whatever that is, you know, wherever on the spectrum you are. And whatever the complex is when you have, like, a child or a progeny that just feels like they need to kill their creator. Mm-hmm. To, like, be their own, to have... It's just a profoundly intense and acute insecurity issue of, like, I can't create life. You know, and like... Right. And I think that's... I mean, that's, I think, maybe a very topical thing. But, you know, I don't, like, the source of patriarchy, it seems so ancient that it is hard to, like, figure out what, right. You know, what is the moment in which this became a thing, a dynamic, and then really at what point did it become violent? Right. Because maybe without the violence, it, you know, wouldn't even be talking about it. But, like, I mean, we would, but maybe it would be just different, you know, it's less urgent or something, but... It's so ancient as a social concept and as a violent dynamic that, you know, I'm constantly begging the question of its use for either side and its intention. And I don't think anybody knows. I don't think maybe we all will know, but I think the psychological day-to-day thing has to do with, like, she created me and she has this thing that I can't have, and she also has this thing that I need, which is her, and she has complete control over if I can have it or not. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's that, it's like three levels of lack of control. And maybe if we had genetic testing in the Stone Ages, there'd be no patriarchy, essentially. Because that, you know, like, yeah. Maybe there was...
Even though we're both based in Chicago, I had to go all the way to Philadelphia to meet our next filmmaker. Darren Wallace is the co-founder of the Kinfolk Collective, a collective of visual artists. He's also a teacher at Black Cinema House in Chicago, and he created a short which is a powerful dramatization of Troy Davis's execution. Here we talk more about his film, Savage Against the Void.
Darren Wallace, director and teaching artist. I teach film right now at Black Cinema House. And yes, I also lead a collective of filmmakers, Kinfolk Collective. Kinfolk Collective is like a tribe of political activists, artists, filmmakers, teachers, and we try to use each other's craft to inform one another in our own work. And eventually we want to start our own school, an HBCU dedicated to the arts, because right now that doesn't exist. And often we found in arts education that people don't understand the political undertones, especially the ideological frameworks in terms of how we teach art and what type of art we respect. And it began out of that need. So I and the other founder, Julian Walker, we were both in grad school for film at Columbia back in 2012, and we just hated our classes. Hated our courses. We didn't like the way that we were being instructed. Just the model for how they taught storytelling was just so contrived and, yeah, limiting. So Kinfolk was really born by just trying to study other art forms, other methodologies in terms of making films, and understanding the political history that goes into that sort of teaching. So yeah, that was kind of like the initial kernel. It's like, okay, how can we study this a little bit better? How can we study other art forms to kind of enhance our own stuff? And how can we teach ourselves to do this, you know, in the midst of being in the school? So that was the kernel of it. And this was like February 2012. And since then, we've grown to maybe like 8 members. And people come and go. It's not like a strict thing at all in terms of like who's in, who's out, nothing like that. But we just actually moved into a great house on the south side. So I, Hiwi Amaru, he's a poet and musician from Chicago, and Ari Marin, she's a cinematographer and a photographer from Milwaukee. And one of the actors in the film, Keith Cerny, he moved in with us as well. And we're in the process of turning our new space into like a gallery, which we also do. Yeah, we do a lot of shit. We do a lot of shit. but most people just know us really for the film stuff. But yeah, that's pretty much who we are.
And I just saw your film, and it was a really, really kind of compelling idea about the dramatization of Troy Davis's execution.
Well, I was inspired about pretty much by that night. I remember campaigning pretty hard with a few other artist activists on behalf of Troy. I don't know if you remember back in 2011, his story got really, really big before he got executed. Amnesty International picked it up, and that's when I realized like also the power of Twitter in terms of like amplifying certain stories. But also what really touched me was just even after all that campaigning and all the work that we had done, it's still been executed. And that was the first time, because most of my art like has to do with like social justice themes. That was like the first time I felt like, damn, I really don't think like art can change it, you know, like can it really intervene in saving someone's life, you know? So I wanted to explore that idea a little bit more. And at the time I was working for an organization that felt a little bit exploitive in terms of how they tried to adjust certain social justice themes through their version or brand of activism. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. A lot of times, especially artists, when we attempt to address these different ideas, these various forms of oppression, sometimes we have a tendency to kind of overlook the subject that we're actually making the work about. So I just wanted to play with that idea a bit. The film is titled Savage Versus the Void, and the writing process took a long time because it was a play set within a film, you know, so I had to write like these lines as if, okay, what would this director want these people to say? How would this play out? And I was fortunate to be in Chicago, which is, I think it's like the best city in the world for theater. Like I've seen so many amazing plays that changed my life. So I wanted to do something to honor that as well. So studied a lot of film writers, specifically Patty Chayefsky. You know about him at all? He wrote a Network and a few other things, but Network is what he's most famous for, and he came from a theater background. So I like to study his writing a lot, specifically because it has like this satirical tone and it addresses a lot of social justice issues as well. And beyond that, just seeing a lot of experimental plays, just in thinking about, okay, what can we do on a stage? You know, it's different when you're making a film that has nothing to do with theater, and you can place the camera wherever, but just seeing that theater space and seeing how other people use black box theaters really, really helped me in terms of like crafting it on the page.
And there's a really interesting line that the director character in your work said, but the truth doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
it's the story.
Yeah, that was the line I actually heard from a teacher at Columbia. Mm. Yeah, he was like, we have a higher calling, you know, than just trying to depict the truth, you know. Which is really interesting because truth in filmmaking really doesn't exist. You know, editing shapes and frames things and lies to audiences all the time, you know. But just this idea that turning this man into like a symbol, you know, that the flesh and blood, the body, the person actually doesn't matter at all. But the narrative that comes from that is much more important. That's something that I kind of hear a lot around certain filmmakers, certain writers. And I wanted to push back against that a bit, you know.
If you want to keep up with Black film, your best bet is to follow Real Black and its founder, Michael Dennis. Not only is Michael Dennis a booster of all things Black and media, he is an award-winning filmmaker in his own right. I'm so glad I got a chance to talk to Mike D about film and the festival. It's always a blast whenever we talk.
I'm Michael Dennis. I'm the founder of Real Black, Philly's number one promoter of Black film and a proud supporter of the Black Star Film Festival since its inception. Black Star, I mean, A, it's like family. I mean, what's really cool, most of the filmmakers stay for the entire run of the festival. And, you know, although it's a little frustrating, it's almost impossible to see every film. The community that's built and the conversations that happen here are just inspiring. I can honestly say that, you know, after, even though it's a very exhausting and worth the last day as we tape this, I'm fed, I'm inspired, and it gives me, like, the next 6 months, I'll live from all the information and inspiration and just seeing you, so.
And seeing you is always a pleasure, Mike.
Yeah, Shaka, you gotta. But, you know, we're spreading the seeds out here into the interweb. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, if people can't be here at Black Star, they really need to make every effort to come and see it and come next year and ensure that it continues by becoming a member of Black Star. It's only $100, but every dollar, you know, it goes towards something to help support this thing. And it really... another thing about the festival, it really is like an oasis. I mean, there's so many festivals that I go to that are Black film related, and they're, you know, I'm not going to say people here don't have their eye on the industry, but they're not, the level of integrity in the work is at a higher caliber. And, you know, when you have Haile Gerima and Julie Dash at the same festival, you know, very accessible, willing to conversate and conduct panels, you know, you're gonna sway a few people's thought process, you know. So even if they do get a job directing Think Like a Man 3, you know, maybe there'll be some content in there that is authentically part of the diaspora, you know. So,
and that's incredible. Like, Mike, was that a little bit of film shade?
Well, I
you don't throw film shade, though, so this isn't delightful.
What, you haven't listened to my radio show. I throw film shade all day. I have to be very careful, though, because, you know, you want to have to be very careful because on a certain level, you don't know what everybody's struggle is. But the filmmakers I do respect, there's an intention and motive beyond money. And I think a lot of people, they get into show business, they want to be in entertainment because they see it as an opportunity to be famous or make money or whatever. And, you know, as Haile says, you know, it's a very powerful propagandic tool. You know, if you know, like Haile's thing, you know, like white supremacy runs 24/7. And whenever there's an opportunity for a Black person to tell their story, they have to be aware of how that's used ordinarily. So if it's your choice to emulate what's already been done in terms of imagery and stereotypes and it's cool if you just want to tell stories, but you know, if you're making films and you're not aware of the stereotypes, colorism, the way power is used, you know, big thing was talked about, like a lot of people say, well, we couldn't get funding unless we put a white character into the movie, and that's those are the kind of things, those are the kind of battles that are, that everybody's up against, you know, in terms of how do you get the uncut pure, how can you get black film up to the level that we saw with black music. Like nobody's questions, I mean, you know, unless it's like Pharrell deciding to use Robin Thicke, you know, there's no issue when it comes to like black musicians making music that's authentic to them, you know. And yeah, clearly there are hybrids. Like I love Rick Rubin and what he did with Def Jam, and it allows people to make the music more accessible. But you know, I it's the integrity. That's the smell test. When I watch films, you know, when I see them compromised, and they always get compromised when they go through a Hollywood system.
Going back to the festival this year gave me a sense of nostalgia. I can remember being in a conference room of the Leeway Foundation 5 years ago and talking to my friend, filmmaker, Philadelphia creative ambassador, and the founder and producing artistic director of the Black Star Festival, Mayori Carmel Holmes. And she brought us all together because she said that the summer was coming and she wanted to make a, not a festival, she said, but just a way to show some films that she wanted to get more attention after the successful run of her monthly film series, Kinowatt. So she stressed that, you know, not like a festival, but I just want to get people together to see some films. Well, Mayori just doesn't know how to think small or do anything small. So that is why not only did we have a festival, but over the next 5 years, we now have something that has definitely grown beyond many festivals who have reached just their 5-year anniversary. I had a great chance to talk to Mayori about the growth of Black Star, the future of Black Star, and what filmmakers can do if they're interested in submitting to Black Star.
I mean, we're really thankful that people are finding home with us and that they're still interested in attending and supporting and, you know, rocking out with us, and we don't take that for granted, and we're really trying to find a way to be inventive and supportive, and I think find a way to contribute to the space. You know, I would never say that we're putting filmmakers on, or, you know, I wouldn't say anything like that, but we're happy that we can be a platform for some people to connect them to audiences that maybe they hadn't connected with before. And, you know, we're excited to be a part of that. This was the first year we were able to help youth with travel, and so we had a lot of them in attendance. We were also able to have like a separate, you know, we had a reception for them. You know, we really just made, I think, that more of a special experience. We sold more festival passes than we ever have before, which is great, because, I mean, in my ideal world, we would be pass only. You know, I think, I haven't seen the numbers, but the numbers feel about the same. I could be wrong, but they feel the same. We changed the date of the award ceremony to Saturday, which was an experiment, and so that was a change from the past. We also had a filmmaker symposium before the festival began, which was also new. And so,
if I am a filmmaker of a short and I really want to get into Black Star, what would you advise me to do when I'm in the production process?
I wouldn't think about Black Star. I would think about the film that I want to make. That's what I would advise you to do.
I also had a great chance to talk to my friend Nuela Cabral. In addition to being a filmmaker in her own right, her film Walking Home is one of the first visual representations about street harassment that I had ever seen on the web. At this point, it's been viewed hundreds of thousands of times. She's also a very active media literacy educator, youth advocate, and just a general bad chick. Luckily, we had an opportunity to talk with her too.
My name is Nuela Cabral, and I am community outreach coordinator for Black Star Film Festival. The youth program was definitely a highlight. I've been involved with the youth program for 4 years now, and it just keeps getting better and better. This year we had young people, we had films from produced by young people from across the country, and a lot of those young people came out to the screening and participated in the Q&A, and that was really powerful. We saw films ranging from issues like police brutality and Islamophobia to selling drugs and poverty, education, standardized testing, and how that affects young people. So there were a lot of like serious issues, but there were also some music videos in there to like pick us up, pick up our spirits, and overall it was really inspiring. There was one film directed by a 14-year-old here in Philadelphia. Her name was Ayana. She directed a film called Skin that was really powerful, and now she wants to make it into a feature film. So that was great. Also, there was a master class that was taught by filmmakers, facilitated by filmmakers who've been in our festival before and who are in our festival again this year. And Tahir Jeter and Sabrina Gordon, they did a class, a workshop where they talked about their process and showed clips of their work, and the young people in the room got to ask questions, and I think they got a lot out of that as well. One thing that's really special about Black Star is that we even have a youth program. A lot of film festivals don't have youth programs, and it's an incredible experience when you're a young filmmaker and you have an opportunity to show your work in front of an audience and attend a festival as a filmmaker. You know, to be exposed to other independent films is huge. And so I think that's one thing that makes Black Star really special. Also, it's just tons and tons of amazing independent films produced by Black people about our stories, our history, our lives in very complicated, nuanced ways. And you don't really get that. I mean, I haven't been to other Black film festivals, so I can't compare it. Well, I have been to a Pan-African film festival. That was a long time ago. But I think Black Star is cutting edge because they're sharing a diverse range of Black stories, stories by Black people that are complicated and nuanced and real.
I call Eugene Hayes Mr. Black Star because he's in almost every single screening during the festival, but he is also a film scholar in his own right and an artistic advocate. He's also most formally the film program manager for the Black Star Festival, and we had a chance to talk with him about his thoughts about where film is going and the role Black Star has in that.
So I'm Eugene Haynes, and I'm the program manager for the Black Star Film Festival. And essentially what that is I work with the filmmakers that come every year, making sure that they're comfortable, obviously, and that their screenings go well. So that's pretty much it. I've known Mayuri for over 15 years. She was one of the first people that I was introduced to when I relocated from New York City. I was an acquisition executive for what's now called Focus Features, but for the 7 years that I was there, it originated as October Films, and then the incarnation as I left in 2001 was Focus Features. So I've known Mayuri, and she came to me in a conversation talking about how she was really interested in wanting to do a showcasing of films from the continent. And I thought it was a great idea. And I'm like, okay, well, sure, Mayuri, I'm going to show up, because she has a very skilled eye in the curatorial capacity. And come to find out, in another 6 months or so, she's like, I'm doing the Black Star Film Festival. And it was a no-brainer for me to say, listen, Mayuri, whatever I can do to help, volunteer, I'm in. And I've been in since the beginning, and it's been a very rewarding and exciting time. What specifically makes Black Star different from any other festival? And so I've been fortunate enough to be at FestPaco, at Cannes, Toronto, it's Sundance, Urban World, Pan-African, African Black when it was even Acapulco Film Festival. So I've been able to both visit and experience festivals in a variety of different manners. What makes this one very specifically unique is the artist attendance and participation in each other's screenings and question and answer sessions. So I looked in the audience the other day and saw Terrence Nance sitting next to Sean Peters, and in front of them was Matthew Cherry and two other younger filmmakers, and they're all like huddled watching the film, and then come out into the lobby and you see these little pods of creativity like going on all across the lobby here. And that's what essentially makes Black Star extremely unique, in that we're up to, I think, maybe like 97% of the artist participation actually seeing their films with audiences. And that's what is the most unique thing about this. It's really important for us to show the full capacity of what is African, what is Black, and that we have an entire youth-driven and oriented component. So the judges are peer judges in the youth thing. The screenings are specifically designed for the interaction between the mentors and generationally inviting their parents to come and see their work, and having an environment where at a young age you can think that your artistic collaboration can extend well beyond where it is that you're visually or technically at this level, but to then see the variety of different people coming back and commenting is another unique aspect of Black Star that gives us a different foothold. Because of the double entendre capacity of Black Star, you know, that I am maybe not by my membership card, but I would think that I'm a Garveyite of sort, and that whole notion of accomplishing what we will, in the sense that we are, or I am because we are therefore I am, as opposed to just singularly me, 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 me. So when we get into an environment where the collective knows that it is we are, it really empowers the individual. And when I come into the lobby, it's an energy that you feel initially right in, that you know that there's, I don't want to say magic, but you know that there's creativity in the air. And it's just, it's a wonderful time.
Thank you so much to Noella Cabral, Eugene Hayes, Michael Dennis, Terrence Nance, Darren Wallace, and Black Star Film Festival founder Mary Karma Holmes for taking the time to talk with me. As this is the last episode of the High Water Podcast until next season, thank you to all of the guests we've had this season, our supporters, sponsors, commenters, subscribers, likers, tweeters, and fans. I also need to give a very heartfelt thanks to the Post Loudness Podcast community and network, and the Lucius Lion, to my street rapper with a heart of gold, the amazing James T. Green, for producing the show and making one of my dreams come true. Continue to follow High Water on social media. We're High Water Mag on the Twitters and the Facebooks, and our website is gethighwater.com. Go to gethighwater.com for more creative fuel for your practice and for information on the second season. As you know by now, if you've been tuning in, the best way to complain is to make stuff. So get back to work, and I will see you until next time. The High Water Podcast is a production of Post Loudness, a collective of independent audio shows by people of color, women, and queer-identified hosts. You can learn more about Post Loudness by checking out postloudness.com. I will see you next time.
Post Loudness. Audio.